Welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show. I'm David Gardner, broadcasting from Fool Global Headquarters here in Alexandria, Virginia, here each week to talk about the motley world of business and investing. And on this week's show, we're going to talk money and the movies with film critic Leonard Maltin, a several times returned guest on the show who always has a lot to say about the business of Hollywood. We're also going to take your phone calls, but we begin the show by talking about the week that was, and here to provide some additional perspective is Fool Radio economics contributor Charlie Whelan, author of the book Naked Economics. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago. Charlie, welcome back.
My pleasure.
Charlie, let's begin by talking about the terrorist bombings in London. We are a business show, but business certainly doesn't exist in a vacuum. What are your thoughts on this week's terrorist attacks in London?
Well, I suspect there will be some economic fallout, and it's not because of the direct damage, although that's obviously a tragedy. But clearly it's not the case that the infrastructure of business has been destroyed or disrupted, or that the loss of life is on such a scale that it's going to disrupt the economy. Mm-hmm. The cost, I think, in the long run is from the uncertainty that it engenders, in that people who were going to spend or going to go on vacation or going to go build a plant might have second thoughts now. And it doesn't take much of that indecision or postponing spending to ripple throughout the economy. So let me give you just one hypothetical example. Suppose that in the near term, British Airways decides that there perhaps will be a small downturn in travel. And so they, in turn, postpone or cancel an order they might have made with Boeing for the new 787. And Boeing, in turn, sees a downturn and lays off folks here in Chicago because that's where they're headquartered. And those folks stop going out to dinner because they've lost their jobs. It's not hard to see that ripple effect. And that's just one little example. So it's really driven by the uncertainty, not the direct economic damage.
Mm. Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." Charlie, is there a danger in whether or not a worse future comes to us through terrorism, just spending a lot of resources to guard against it, possibly creating a world that we didn't want to live in anyway?
Well, the real danger is that in looking to the future and being concerned about some kind of downturn or another attack, that we actually create the bad economic outcome that we're worried about. So, for example, our rational response, either as a business firm or as a family managing a budget, is to say, all right, I'm a little more uncertain about the future than I was before because there could be follow-on terrorist attacks, or maybe I just run a business that's now more susceptible because of a downturn in travel or dining out or something. And as soon as we all collectively tighten our purse strings, there's the danger that we then actually create the downturn that we were worried about because it's our spending, of course, that generates income for everybody else. So there is a certain self-fulfilling prophecy here that's possible. That, of course, is the underlying analysis behind Franklin Delano Roosevelt's admonition that all we have to fear is fear itself. Mm. If we stop spending because we're worried about the future, we will create that future that we're worried about.
Seems to me that the terrorists know that too, Charlie. What we've learned about Al-Qaeda is that they think in economic terms as well.
Well, they think about disrupting anything that can be disrupted. And of course, the economy, whether it's in Britain or the U.S., is of course one of our great vulnerabilities because it's one of our great strengths. And you obviously want to attack where somebody is really strong. So the fact that we're also relatively open societies also makes us more vulnerable to this kind of attack. We wouldn't want to live in a world necessarily where you've got to go through metal detectors to get on public transit. The costs in terms of time and inconvenience would just be prohibitive. And therefore, as long as we maintain that kind of open ability to get on and off a train at rush hour, there's a certain heightened vulnerability.
Mm. Charlie, let's shift gears and talk a bit about the topic that was expected to be the primary focus of this week's discussion between you and me, and that would be the G8 summit, economic aid to Africa. A lot of pressure on countries like the UK and the United States to increase our percentage of aid to African countries.
Well, it's not an exaggeration to say literally that the future of the world is on the agenda, both on the global warming side and whether the European nations can convince the United States to take a more aggressive stance towards global warming, but also on the foreign aid side. And if you look around sub-Saharan Africa and other places, the level of dire poverty is indeed stupendous. And so there have been calls from public figures like Bob Geldof and Bono, but also Tony Blair on the government front, for the United States and the other industrialized nations to take a far more aggressive stance in fighting poverty and disease, particularly in Africa.
And we hear about the poverty, HIV, obviously a huge topic internationally, malaria in Africa. Let's start by asking, why not increase foreign aid to Africa?
Well, first of all, I think we should talk about how the magnitude of the problem and how discouraging it has been. If you look at life expectancy, it's basically declining in much of sub-Saharan Africa, and it is no better than it was in 1950. And if you think about that period of time from 1950 to 2005, the magnitude of gains in terms of medicine and modern drugs and fighting communicable diseases, it is indeed striking that there's been no progress on the longevity front. And we see a similar story with GDP, that basically in much of sub-Saharan Africa, the countries are as poor as they were half a century ago. Indeed, I saw a stunning figure in The Economist recently that half a century ago, Zambia and South Korea had roughly the same per capita income. South Korea is now 32 times richer than Zambia. So it's a place of utter despair in terms of income, disease, life expectancy, and so on. And that, of course, is the big argument in favor of doing something, anything, to try and help this desperate situation. The cautionary tale is that we've been trying to do things, perhaps not on the scale that a Tony Blair or Obama would like to see, but the record of intervention in places like sub-Saharan Africa over the last half century is quite poor. There have been a series of different development fashions, if you will, from large infrastructure projects like dams to the current craze in microfinance, and we have yet to find a model that we can simply roll out to take a very poor country and make it richer.
One more question for you here, just because I think it's such an important topic, Charlie. The Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto wrote a book a few years ago, I'm sure you've read it, The Mystery of Capital, in which he contended that the best way to solve world poverty is by giving property rights to the many people who are disenfranchised around the world who've built up their shanty outside of Mexico City or Manila, but are not accorded ownership of that. They cannot borrow against their assets, the improvement of land. They can't start their own businesses because of trillions of dollars of dead capital around the world. Do you agree with De Soto on that point, or do you disagree?
I agree completely. Now, I think it's a more difficult step to take than it may seem, but the idea of dead capital is a really important one, that there are people who actually own things, even in very poor countries, whether it's animals or whether it's a hut that they've built themselves. But since they don't have property rights, the thing that we take for granted in the developed world, they can't point to a deed that says, I own this land, I own this house. They can't borrow against that asset, and therefore they have no access to credit that they might use to expand a business or start a business or something like that. So it basically erases an important financial asset from any poor country. Now, the question is, how do you get to a place where people actually have those property rights? And, of course, that requires the rule of law. It requires a semi-honest and efficient court system. It requires some process for surveying land and figuring out who really owns it. All of those things are very difficult in a country without very good infrastructure, with a poor education system, perhaps a corrupt government, and so on.
Mm. Charlie Whelan is the author of the book Naked: Economics Undressing the Dismal Science, and a regular commentator on this show. Charlie, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks. It was great to be with you.
Every man has an equal right to live.